Good morning. I'm Ashmita Patnaik with the Public Policy Research Institute at Texas A&M University. I have no disclosures to make. In 2008, about 31 million children in the U.S. were eligible for Medicaid Early and Periodic Screening, Diagnostic and Treatment Services, or EPSDT. In 2009, almost 3 million children in Texas were eligible for EPSDT benefits. A subset of these children who face serious chronic illness and live in the community also require personal care services called PCS. PCS is provided by personal care assistants to compensate for limitations in activities of daily living, or ADLs, and instrumental activities of daily living, IADLs, that result from the child's illness or chronic condition. In a collaborative project with the Texas Health and Human Services Commission, we at Texas A&M University and the Texas A&M University Health Science Center developed an assessment tool, which we call the Personal Care Assessment Form, to determine a child's need for personal care services in the home. Our effort was specifically designed to recognize the reality of home care for children. This is an environment in which program staff and health professionals are dependent on reports from informal caregivers about the child's needs and strengths. For the analysis I'm presenting today, our goal was to develop a classification model that mimicked as closely as possible the basic logic underlying the allocation of hours of PCS per week to children in the Medicaid PCS program in Texas. The ultimate goal was to produce a set of client categories, also called case mix or classification groups, made up of children who receive about the same amount of care and who share a number of important characteristics. Now, you may ask, if we have a uniform assessment process, why would a classification system that's based on a child's needs be useful? When we looked at our data, we found that a substantial amount of the variance in the PCS authorized depended solely on the identity of the case manager completing the assessment. The R-square for such a model was 0.18. This result implies that one-fifth of the variation in the allocation of PCS for children in Texas may depend on which case manager assessed them. Such variation in resource allocation that has no basis in client characteristics can quickly lead to inefficient, inequitable, and ineffective allocation of the scarce program resources that are available to provide care for this vulnerable population. When two children with the same basic needs receive different levels of service, this introduces inequity into the program. And so a classification model that's based on the child's needs can be useful. We collected data over a six-month period from September 2008 through February 2009. Our target population was all children between the ages of 4 through 20, receiving personal care services through the Medicaid PCS program. Data was collected during the regularly scheduled evaluations of children seeking or receiving PCS. The personal care assessment form for children 4 through 20 was used. And the assessments were completed by case managers employed by the Texas Department of State Health Services in the 11 health regions in Texas. We received a total of 2,842 assessments. Of these, 3% or 83 assessments were deleted because of missing data or because Medicaid PCS was denied. The instrument that we used is the one that we built for the Texas Health and Human Services Commission. And it's based on several items included in the minimum data set for nursing home resident assessment and the minimum data set for home care. Both the MDS and the MDS-SC were developed for use with frail elderly and have proven reliability and validity when used with older populations. When we developed our instrument, we added items and we reformulated several items so that they apply to our study population of children. The instrument included 10 measures of a child's ability to perform activities of daily living, bed mobility, positioning when upright, eating, locomotion inside, locomotion outside, transfers, using toilet, dressing, personal hygiene, and bathing. And these were rated on a 6-point scale ranging from independent, needs setup only, needs supervision, needs limited assistance, needs extensive assistance, to total dependence. All the information about the child's health status came from caregiver or client reports that were recorded by the case manager. or from the case manager's unstructured observations during the assessment process. Our dependent variable was the amount of personal care service hours per week that were authorized by the case managers who completed a 7-day, 24-hour flow sheet. After reviewing the literature and our data set, we selected the characteristics listed here to be considered in our modeling effort. These include characteristics of the child, such as age, gender, ADL needs, IADL needs, cognitive function, medical diagnosis, behaviors, incontinence, etc. We also included some characteristics of their primary caregiver who reported barriers to care, such as being in school or working full-time, part-time, etc. We used the SAS Enterprise Miner 6.1 software, and we used the statistical procedure that used PCS hours as the dependent variable, and then optimized the model's R-square by picking certain breaks on the independent variables that we included. Now, you can allow the software to completely control the analysis and classification, and it will pick and choose independent variables and select cut points on those variables in whatever order maximizes the variance. But we didn't use this simplistic, purely statistical approach. We used a blended approach to model building, which involved specifying some aspects of the classification model based on conceptual or clinical considerations, and then letting the software determine the specific cut points. Our simplest model that explained a reasonable amount of the variation in PCS hours authorized included only a single summary ADL scale, which we call the hands-on ADL scale. This scale was based on the number of ADLs in which the child needed or received hands-on assistance. And we chose this scale because each level in the scale had a clear meaning. For example, a score of 6 means that the child needed or received hands-on assistance with 6 ADL items. The model that used just this ADL scale resulted in an R-square of 0.20 and resulted in 6 distinct groups of children. The lowest need category was the largest, made up of 835 children who needed hands-on assistance in up to 3 ADL items, and members of this group received about 18 hours of PCS per week. The children in the highest need category, made up of 498 children, needed hands-on assistance in 9 to 10 ADL items, and they received an average of 35 hours of PCS per week. We explored another classification model that first created groups of children based on the child's age, and then within each age group used the child's score on the hands-on ADL scale. This model fit the data much better, with the R-square increasing from 0.20 to 0.30, and this model generated 14 groups of children listed above. The lowest need group was made up of 443 children, 4 through 9 years of age, who received hands-on assistance with up to 4 ADL items, and this group received an average of 17 hours of PCS per week. The highest need group was made up of 208 children aged 18 through 20 years who received hands-on assistance with 7 to 10 ADL items, and they received an average of 44 hours of PCS per week. The other variables that we listed earlier were considered and tested in alternative models, but the variables either added very little explanatory power to the model, or they affected only a small number of the subgroups, or they affected only a very small number of children. To maintain our model's ability to be used with all children and to make the model less bound to the specifics of the children in our sample, we didn't include these indicators in our final model. So model 2 is our preferred model, and we chose this on the basis of statistical fit, general applicability, and conceptual clarity. It's based on 2 fundamental questions asked in sequence. How old is the child, and in how many ADL items does the child need hands-on assistance? We believe that this classification model can be used practically as guidelines for the case managers or for administrative quality control. But in order to do that, we really need to build corridors around the average estimates for each of those 14 subgroups. So in order to do that, we looked at the cumulative distribution of hours in each of the 14 subgroups. The mean of each group is at approximately the 55th percentile. And if you go up the distribution by 25% and go down by 25%, you get corridors at the 30th percentile and 80th percentile. For example, if you look at group one, which is 443 children, 4 through 9 years of age, needing hands-on assistance with up to 4 ADLs. The average PCS authorized for this group is 17 hours. But if we look at our at the 30th percentile and the 80th percentile, we get a corridor of 11 through 23 hours of PCS. When we look at our preferred model, which was model 2, you will find a number of excluded items. For example, the model has no information on the child's medical diagnosis, health conditions, cognitive function. But this is because diagnosis, health conditions, cognitive function, they have an indirect effect on PCS authorizations, which is mediated through the child's physical function. Some of the other indicators like IADLs and incontinence were very highly correlated with age and the ADL scale, and so they added no predictive power to the model. We also included information on the nature of caregiver barriers, but these did not have any effect on PCS hours authorized. When we look at classification models, we have to keep in mind that these are designed to mimic as closely as possible the current patterns of care provision, but that may or may not reflect the ideal pattern of care provision. However, the classification models do represent, as best as we can, the collective wisdom of hundreds of case managers as they attempt to meet the needs of thousands of children facing a wide variety of challenges in a wide array of environments. They also reflect the requests for services that are made by thousands of concerned adults who are seeking personal care for the children for whom they're responsible. As I mentioned earlier, the classification models can be used as potential benchmarks for the administrative review of PCS allocations, either by government agencies or by child advocacy groups. They can also be used by the case managers themselves as starting points in their consideration of the services needed by children. But either of these uses needs to recognize that the classification model provides a structure that's based on the shared characteristics of children in the program. But beyond these shared characteristics, there is a wide array of special circumstances that can affect a specific child's needs, and those do need to be considered in the decision to authorize PCS. Thank you. These are my co-authors, Dr. Phillips from School of Rural Public Health, Dr. Dyer, and Emily Neiser from PPRI. If you'd like more information on our project, you can visit our website at pcaf.tamu.edu. Thank you.
Thank you. We now have time for questions and an announcement by our program chair. Yes. Yeah. Do we have? That'd be great. Steve's going to come by with a roving mic, and we're going to turn the lights up, both so you can see the panelists as well as the photo exhibit. We've had a really fascinating presentation that really looks at this issue of medical care and unmet medical care from a variety of perspectives. Two studies looking at the METs, one really focusing in on issues of disparities among people with non-ADL limitations as well as ADL limitations. Another study really focusing on the issue of expenditures and out-of-pocket costs in particular. Another one really taking this to another place of having women, in essence, women vets tell their own story with impact at a very immediate and local level. And then finally, an analysis of how our personal care services allocated for children with special health care needs, at least within Texas, all very intriguing and raising a range of questions. So I'm going to open it up for questions from the audience.
Hello.
You got it.
I just want to say that I really enjoy all of the presentations. My name is Beverly Lewis. I'm from the state of Louisiana, who dat. And I'm also in the Air Force Reserve, Lieutenant Colonel with the 917th Medical Squad. So Dr. Ron, I'd like to say thank you for your presentation. It's very personal for me as I am involved with some of this. And also as a public health nurse, I enjoyed the presentation in with the children, but I enjoyed it also. I just have to say thank you. Okay, next.
Hi, Tom Goldman from UT Austin. My question is directed about the measurement of disability in the MEPS. And two points that I would raise are looking at disability as sort of yes, no, simply based on ADLs. It seems like one thing is to maybe look at the continuum depending on the number of ADLs. And I don't know if you looked at that.
We have one limitation in the MEPS that the ADL, IDL questions are asked in summary fashion. So we don't get the exact breakout of which specific ADLs or IDLs. We get an overall snapshot of yes to any of the following. So that's it's a data limitation. I completely agree with you. It would be demonstrative, I think, to cut further in and look at the number and distribution of types of specific ADLs. I would love to be able to do that. Another point I'd quickly make is that we're not just making one, zero, one, you're disabled, you're not. What we're doing is saying there's a universe of folks that have disabilities, and within that universe, we have some that are telling us that the disability experiences that they're having are impacting on their abilities for self-care, whereas others are not. So we've made I agree, that's still, our whole presentation is as macro, top level as you can get. There's a lot of work that really needs to be done at a more specific kind of level at the same time.
And maybe one follow-up question. In the MEPS survey, do they ask about official designation in terms of disability, whether they receive SSI or SSDI?
Yeah, they do. Go ahead. They do ask that question. Actually, in some of my ADL, in our definition, we included that as well. As a sensitivity analysis, what we would do is if they receive SSDI benefits, then they would be considered as official, under the official definition of disability. Yeah.
One future direction I would suggest is really looking at those people who receive the official designation versus those who have ADLs but are not at that point yet. And as a plug for the next session, we're going to talk about this issue of prevention of disability. And I think your talks were a very good prelude to some of our talks.
Beth Rash from NIH. We're doing some work with the Social Security Administration using their data to examine their disability determination process. And I have to take issue with this notion of SSA determination as being the official determination of disability. It's really a very specific population of people who apply for benefits. We know from the SSA data they tend to have very low-skilled, low-paid jobs. They tend to be people without resources. People with resources, with higher education, with more options, tend not to apply for benefits because they have other options. They can get accommodations more easily, they can, you know, make alterations and continue to work, or they have other resources that they can fall back on. So if you really have to be careful when you look at that population because it's a very specific population. I understand why people are doing that, but it's a big caveat. That's all I'm going to say.
Mitch LePlan from UCSF, and this is a question to Stephen.
Usha.
Very good presentation, but I walked in just as you were describing the two approaches, and the ARC approach and the RDE approach, but What strikes me is that in Whitehead's original formulation of disparities, it is all about access and problems in access that are related to power differentials and class differentials. So I just would like a clarification as to how could it possibly even be considered legitimate to like control for that in the RDE approach?
What I can tell you is that in the general disparities literature, you will see a range of studies, some of which specifically including SES is one of the control variables. So we're looking at poverty, we're looking at education, we're looking at employment status, those kinds of variables. And there are some who are of the philosophic bent.
Steve, could you move the microphone?
Yes. There are some who take the sort of philosophic, you know, approach that we can somehow disaggregate the effects of class from race. There are others who would very passionately disagree that it's possible to really tease those things apart in mathematical kinds of models, and that if you have a circularity of things predicting each other, you know, such that if you have differential access to the employment market based on, let's say, Hispanic ethnicity, then that's kind of in the causal pathway, in a sense, of some of the other kinds of outcomes that we might want to look at. So the approach that I was taking here was to give you the two extremes. One which says treat them all as potential disparity, sort of the AHRQ approach, versus the RDE approach which says control for the kitchen sink. And if we control for everything else that we can think of, and race and ethnicity still come back as significant, then that's a disparity. And so my point wasn't to elevate the one versus the other, but to demonstrate the range of possibilities. I actually, if you're asking me my own personal opinion, I think the IOM definition makes a lot of sense, which is we do need some kind of reasonable controls for differences in health status, differences in service need, for these models to make much sense. We also need controls for some basic things, like, so we know gender is highly correlated with use of health services across the board. We need that control in there. But on the other hand, folks that have operationalized the IOM definition have said, no, keep SES out. Don't use that as a control variable because it's misleading. That's where I would probably, and that's also the next step for our study. We've only given you these two. We want to do the middle one as well.
Well, as I recall, Whitehead conditioned her whole exposition about disparities on the basis of need. So I think that's built into Whitehead's approach. Obviously, if you're going to compare, let's say, healthcare utilization of people with disabilities to people without disabilities, you do need to control for need, because otherwise people with disabilities will be higher. Yeah. Right. So anyway. I'm just concerned with the RDE approach that
I am too.
As many people I think would be that you're throwing the baby out with the bathwater when you're trying to control for the sink.
That was just the final follow-up.
Something like that.
I just wanted to...
You and me both, and that was kind of the point. That's what we were trying to show.
Yeah. I want to add, a follow-up comment to that. Most of the time when we do the, pull apart the differences between two groups, our interest is mainly what explains this. You know, if there is a gap between any two groups, for that matter, race, between disabled and non-disabled, what really explains those gaps? You know, is it socioeconomic status? Is it the health status? It's some other modifiable factors. And this is where I think the social determinants thing, theory also comes in. So if you actually pull apart the differences, and if you can really say these are the differences that you can really eliminate, in the short term, and here is a path for a medium term, and here is a path for a long term, I think that is where I use that approach. It's not so much as, what is really a disparity. It is to explain what really causes this gap and what are the implications of this and how do we go about in eliminating that gap.
I think there were several more questions to the back, so I want to make sure they have a chance to be asked.
Sorry, I missed much of the presentation, but I'd just like to mention to this group that one of the groups which is very much discriminated, so much that they're almost invisible, are people with mental disabilities. It takes them a year, 2 years before they can get to the office and fill out the papers correctly, and it's always wrong the first time in. Folks where I come from think that this is part of a plan to keep those people floating. So you save money that way, reduce the budget, they don't get benefits for a fair amount of time. And the other thing is, back in, if you remember historically, we had a bill, and we had a time when...
I'm going to actually, can I put a hold to this? I'm sorry, yeah, the issue of particular vulnerability for mental health issues was part of it. And I do want to have a chance for some of the other questions for this panel to come forward. So, but thank you. Understand the comment well.
Thank you. Just a logistical question. Do you know how many people with disabilities are in each panel of the MAPS? Is it possible to use the longitudinal nature of each year?
Yeah. Yes. Not so much on this paper, but we have also done a paper on preventive services and disability, I think in women's health issues, if I remember right, where we did use the longitudinal panel. And there our interest was every, individuals who are report disability in the first panel, and then they come back and say no disability. So we were trying to figure out the persistent disability, although it's not an ideal way to do it. So we were like classifying people who said no to at both rounds, panels actually, and then one, either one of those panels, yes. And in both panels they said yes, they have a disability. And we used that mainly to look at the preventive care aspect of it, because we wanted to look at how much insurance actually explained the gap in preventive care. And we wanted to at least somewhat control for the temporal aspects of the preventive care, although it's not ideal. Yeah, to answer your question, yes, it is possible to use the longitudinal data.
A little bit of a further follow-up. You make a choice up front, whether you're interested in following things over time or whether you're interested in making average annualized kinds of estimates. So that's the kind of estimate that I was doing. I wasn't doing an overtime kind of piece. The other thing you should know, though, if you're concerned about the sample size and sort of thinking, gee, is that something that I could, is this a data source that I can tap for a project? Know also that whether you're doing a longitudinal design or whether you're doing an average annual, you can stack panels so that with our study, we were running 2002 through 2004. And that's just about what it took, about 3 years worth of combined data to get sample size large enough specifically to look at the ADL-IDL group. That is a much smaller group. If you're taking the expansive view of any functional limitation, any activity limitation, et cetera, using sort of a kitchen sink approach to disability, you might get by with just 1 year worth of data, because then you're into about 20-odd%.
Do we have more questions? While people are thinking about it, I'm going to ask a question of Ms. Potniak. Your findings, and I know you acknowledge that this isn't ideal, this is indicating what seems to be accounting for the current allocation of personal care services, but the fact that the behavioral issues did not show up for this group of kids, whereas in most other research, it does show up as being an important need and often a service utilization. Do you have any comment about that?
I actually don't have a link up there, but we did another study, and it's out for publication right now, where we did a structural equation modeling, mm-hmm. and we actually saw that medical conditions, health conditions, incontinence, cognitive function, the presence of an intellectual disability, all of that was feeding into their functional impairment as measured by their ADLs. And then ADLs and age were directly impacting PCS hours. So,
but you had a measure of behavioral disturbance as well. Is that right? Something that says this
yes.
child's behavior is difficult to manage?
We have certain items that ask about their behaviors, whether wandering and things like that. Mm-hmm. So one of those was socially inappropriate or disruptive behavior. And that's something that if you did a regular regression or something, it's a factor that does seem to have an impact on PCSRs, but when you put it in with ADLs, it doesn't.
Pathways must be different.
Yes.
Hi, my name is Megan Gleason from the National Institutes of Health. My question was for the disabled veterans presentation. With increasing numbers of women in active duty and coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan, you could anticipate that the number of women who are going to be disabled as a result of combat injuries is going to increase. And you talked a little bit about PTSD being an important factor in sort of what you saw in this pilot project. Do you have any sense of how the VA is sort of gearing up to address probably increasing need for services around those kind of issues?
Is this working? Yes, I think, well, first of all, the VA is recognizing that PTSD and primarily for women that are military sexual trauma, suicide, homelessness, they have identified priority areas. And initiatives actually just rolled out this year to look at believe it or a dozen priority areas and to make sure that each VA is situated in such a way that there's a specific location where those services can be provided. The Women's Comprehensive Health Center is just a little bit different in that the services that men traditionally receive are not located in one comprehensive center. So this may be a transitional model, or it may be that women's health services are contained in one place. But yes, I mean, the VA is prioritizing this area.
Can I follow up on that? I also work with the East Orange VA, and I work with their women's health issues. And one of the things that they have been trying to do is gender concordance. In other words, they have mental health clinics that are either standalone or integrated with primary care clinics, and they are trying to staff those clinics with women providers. And we did find that if you staff those clinics with women providers, they seem to get better services, they seem to get better diagnosis in terms of depression and other mental health issues.
Do we have other questions? Steve is ready with the mic. If not,
I will ask us to acknowledge our panelists one last time. But before we do that, I want to remind us that we have one last very excellent panel starting in this very room in about 33 minutes. Please come back for that. But thank you.